Welcome back to The New You, Life After a Loss to Suicide. This is episode 6, and I am Dawn.
This is Trisha.
And today we're going to cover some topics such as what are your struggles, finding your warriors, and then a little bit about the statistics for suicide and mental health illness, or mental illness. So Trisha, I'll let you begin.
So when you're talking about, like, what are the struggles, like the day-to-day struggles, I would say sometimes there are too many to count. One of the first things I noticed shortly after was the empty chair syndrome. But I'm sure you know what that feels like. Every family event, or, you know, like we used to do Sunday dinners, and it just brings a level of awkwardness to things that was never there before, because when you're not all in the same house or you're not all together, it can be easy to just go about life because it's not right in front of your face. So you do have those moments, like we talked about before, where you forget, you know, like, oh, today seems normal. It's not like she's even gone. But then, like, oh, Sunday dinner. I could cook Sunday dinner and the kids come over and only two kids show up. So then there's this empty chair there. And I think we've gotten better. At first, it was just so heavy and thick, and I would find my son tapping out, like, I have plans. He would eat and run. He would not talk when he came. It was just really hard for him to sit there knowing that there's something so important missing. Did you guys find that at your house, the empty chair?
We did. And honestly, I think we all kind of went our separate ways. We didn't sit down and eat together as much and just kind of handled it differently, I guess. Going back to your empty chair, did you ever try putting the plate there?
No.
So one of the things I had another family do was they still set the plate on the table for that person, just as a reminder that she is still there or they are still there. And maybe just in a different way, but they're still part of your family no matter what you do. So might be something you want to try. Yeah, I agree. I think just the daily struggles, and, you know, my worry is, will things get back to normal? You know, avoiding the holidays right now is just kind of something we're having to do with all these. You know, Easter will be coming up here shortly, and it's hard to go and watch other people's families be happy when we're still in that grieving process. And, you know, knowing what to say. Do I want to hear stories about my child? Absolutely, I do. I think some of them, maybe I don't. but I think it's important that we do not isolate ourselves. And I think we talked about that in the last episode. It's important to get back to life, and our kids and our loved ones wouldn't want that for us. They don't want us to be sad and go through those things. They want us to live, and that's hard. It's hard to rationalize the grief that you're feeling and yet feeling like you should be able to move on.
Right. It changes. It changes your family dynamic, and it's always going to. I noticed it's gotten a little bit easier, and it helps with Walker here. So that's one thing you and I did talk about. You know, Morgan had a son. He was 8 months old when she passed, and now we're getting to where he'll be 2 in June. So he fills some of that hole. You know, he's so much like her. He brings so much joy that it's almost impossible to be unhappy when he's around. And I'd said something early on that I needed to do something different with me, because I don't want Walker to grow up and think, oh, all my grandma ever did was cry when I was little. Because I did at first. Every time I picked him up, I cried. You have, like, it's a heavy weight. I want to know, like, does he remember her? Will he remember her? How am I going to tell him everything about her? Because it's all about that person. That it just, how will I let him know everything? And then you have on the other side, this was something that would anger me at the beginning. And now it's just kind of commonplace that there's people that said, how could she leave him? Wasn't he enough? And that's one of the biggest things I think I will combat forever for him, is her leaving was nothing to do with him. It was 100% to do with her. And I don't ever want him to feel like he has to carry that cross. She didn't leave because she doesn't love him. And quite the contrary, the note she left is that she thought in her mind at that moment that this was the right thing to do for Walker because she couldn't be the mom that she thought he needed here. So she thought by leaving, it would be better for him. But she loved him more than anything in the world. And so I have a job forever to make sure that he knows that. And so I struggle with the finding the balance. Like, how much do I talk about her? How much, I don't want to make everything we ever do about her, because then I think it takes away from a lot of the normal part of life that he's going to have. But I want him to know who she was and how special she was and how much she loved him. So I have a struggle finding that balance. You know, sometimes I find I'll talk about her a lot, and then another day will come and I'll be like, gosh, did I talk about her with him at all? You know, so it's a learning curve. And then we'll get, when he's older and he can ask questions. And I talked about that with his dad one day. What are we going to tell him when he does ask? You know, we keep thinking it'll be easier when he gets older. But then when he asks those questions, I don't know that I have the proper words.
I think you'll find a way if he asks those questions. I think it's important. And I think, you know, we go back to stopping the stigma. In a lot of the reading I've been doing, and I've been doing a lot, one of the things that kind of stuck out to me was, you know, in those final moments, they weren't thinking about anything but feeling better. They weren't thinking about the fight you had with them 20 years ago or whatever the case may be. And one of the things I had told you that I had read recently was, you know, when people say things like suicide is selfish, and really it's not. It's that person stuck in some major depression or something that they can't get out of. The line was something similar to, suicide did not cause the person to die. It was the depression that caused them to die. And that really made me think a little bit more, because if you're so stuck in that depression, it's hard to get out of that hole.
Very, very hard. That's a big thing. I wanted to make sure that my sadness wasn't transferred to his sadness, you know. Although kids are different, they're resilient, they bounce back. So a lot of the technical part of this, he doesn't ever have to worry about until he's older. So for me, bouncing back when he comes and goes is a lot harder than it's ever going to be for him, I'm sure. Part of it that plays into that, my time with him too, is also guilt versus happiness. And we've talked about this before. Like, you'll find yourself in a moment where you just have a real moment that is completely 100% normal. Something happens and you get that real belly laugh, or like you're just enjoying the moment. And as long as you don't think about it, it's going to be fine. And then that instant happens where, how can you enjoy this? She's not here to enjoy this. She's missing it. So that guilt versus happiness, I think, is 10 times heavier when you're looking at her child.
And again, do you feel like, at least I do, do you feel like, A, do you deserve that moment? Yes. B, is she still there with you? Yes. And C, is it just in a different capacity? Yes. Would she want you to feel that way? Absolutely not. And that's hard, because that's our inner self saying it's okay, but it's that struggle back and forth that it's okay, no, it's not okay, it's okay, it's not okay. And I think we just have to allow ourselves some grace, and that's hard to do.
Some days it's exhausting. You just get like, you know, screw it. If you're gonna laugh, you have to laugh. Like, I'm tired of fighting it. I'm tired of thinking about it. And then I also think, like, I don't want to steal that from Walker. You don't want to steal that from your other kids or my other kids. There's moments where you just have to enjoy them because it's just natural. And to take that away from everyone else would be so unfair. So when we're talking about grandkids, I know you and your husband are in a different situation, you know, with Britt. So what are your thoughts and his thoughts on grandkids?
Well, so we probably will never have grandkids. We have two other children. Our oldest daughter doesn't want children. And our youngest, I don't know, will ever get to that point in his life. And so we're kind of on the opposite end. I mean, we would love to have had somebody to carry on the legacy, but it's not in the books for us. So that's been a challenge. I mean, I think we surround ourselves with love, but it's just different not being able to have that grandchild in your arms. And when you see all of your friends, you know, going through that stage, it's hard.
And I think about you guys a lot when I get a reprieve from the everyday battle that we have when he's here. And I think about the people that don't get that and how hard that has to be for them to get through the day. And I honestly don't know. And this is a lot of weight for a little guy to carry, but I don't know how I would have done it the last year and a half without him. I really don't.
It's amazing what those little hearts can do to you.
Yeah. He exhausts me to no end's nothing. I realize how old and out of shape I am, but he also fills my heart with so much joy some days that it's really hard to be unhappy.
Yeah.
So when we're in this, you know, in this emotional roller coaster, and we're trying to get through the daily struggles, one of the things that sometimes happens organically and sometimes you have to work at it is finding your warriors, or sometimes I call it your soul family. And these are people that get it, and you don't have to explain it. You don't have to walk them through the whys and the what happens, and they just understand. Because sometimes I notice it's easier to connect with a complete stranger than it is sometimes to connect with a person that's so close to you. So what did you notice going early through that?
I think, again, we were kind of in that isolation mode. And COVID did not help that. It was, you know, get up, do your daily stuff, go to work, come home. And you're so exhausted. Honestly, it was hard to maintain a lot of those friendships anyway. But I think for me, my turning point was when I got to meet you and being able to just have that discussion. And it's not that there weren't other people here in the community that could have helped me. And I know that many of them didn't want to reach out right away just because they had been through it and they knew the emotional battle that was happening. But I honestly did. I thought, oh, I'm doing pretty good and handling things. And the first day that Trisha and I met, we sat for 6 hours in, I think it was Applebee's, and that poor waiter, actually, I think we had, what, 2 or 3 different waiters?
Yeah.
Changing shifts.
Went through some shifts.
Yeah. And for me, I guess that was probably my turning point, and just being able to release some of the things that I thought I was doing okay with, and I found I really wasn't.
Yeah. It's funny that we've talked about it a lot, how I'm almost 6 months further into this than you are, which is neither here nor there, but you think, you know, because everybody tells you timing, you put these restrictions on yourself, you know, when I get to 1 year, it'll be fine. All the firsts will be done. Well, that's not true, because forever you're going to have things that are going to be a first without her. But I think you put this thought that in your head that I'm going to be okay at this point. And then you get to that point and it's like, shit, I'm not okay. I am not okay. So then you meet someone, and I went in there thinking, oh, you know, I'll be able to help her so much. And we sat down at that table and we started talking. I said, Jesus, she's so far ahead of me in terms of acceptance, and everybody's different and we all have different angles. And the longer we talked, the more things that came out. And I know my husband had texted me, so I thought, you're just having lunch. What are you doing? I said, well, we are, but we're staying till supper. But I think you find comfort in your misery. And it's the strangest thing to say. I didn't have to fill the void with you. You know, if I had to stop and I had to take a minute and I had to cry, you pass me a napkin or get me a glass of water. It's just one of those things that when somebody understands you to that level, they are sitting in your seat and they can finish that sentence. And if you get halfway through a thought, you already know what I'm thinking. And it's strange.
Which for those listening, that is scary.
For our parents, they're like, holy cow, not too. Yeah. So, and I think that was the hard thing for our husbands to get to, like, you're doing what? And you just with this no person you don't even know. Yep, for sure. Yeah. And then you find that they just know this situation from the inside out. Something that somebody on the outside will never feel. And I have my brother-in-law that definitely, I mean, he had lost 2 to suicide. However, he is not as verbal or forthcoming as you. And part of that is that he's a guy. He does that in private. And another part of him is he's a very composed person, and he likes to keep that close to the belt. So it was shortly thereafter we started talking that we realized we could just word vomit and get it all out there, and it was all going to be okay. And when I left there, it was almost the most soul-cleansing feeling. Like, I had been carrying all this yuck for so long that I threw it out all on the table. And you always think, God, what are people going to think of me? And you didn't think anything different of me when I left there than when I came.
Right.
So it was very comforting.
And it was kind of interesting, too, because, again, we had never met prior to this in person. And so I had walked in and had my backpack full of stuff I wanted to share. And she said, oh, thank God. She said, my husband thought I was crazy when I walked out with the backpack as well. So I guess for us, it was almost like a soul connection and just finding that other half of yourself. Trish and I were talking earlier, too. I was reading a different book, and it talked about how many people during that isolation phase don't feel like they have someone that they can talk to, which to me is sad because I think everyone needs that. But it also talked about how suicide families are a little bit different than other families because, A, not only are they trying to process the why and the how and all of that, but they're also trying to process their loss at the same time. And it's different because, you know, if your child dies of cancer or your family member dies of a car accident, you have something to blame it on. And when you don't have that blame to put somewhere and you have to look inward, I think that leads us to a whole nother level of isolation. What are people going to think? How are they going to react? And I don't know, that just kind of struck me differently.
Yeah. We're both reading that same book, and I think at first it hit me the wrong way because there's a large majority of the people in that book, and it is a book about, it's a true story, and it's a gal whose husband was a well-known doctor who took his own life, and she chose, instead of talking about that, she chose to hide it and tell everyone he died of a massive heart attack. And I think right away that left a bad taste in my mouth because I remember, you know, those first few days, and you're thinking, you know, and like you said, your husband said, what's everyone going to think? And you do think that initially. And then it's like, who cares? Who cares? And that was when I, you know, I told my family, I said, my daughter's not going to be a statistic. She's more than that. Yes, she did this, but she's not going to forever be the girl who killed herself. There's more to her than that. And if we're going to have context about it, it's going to be open and we'll talk about it all. Because I think that's where a lot of the stigma comes from. We don't want to tell anybody they killed themselves. Why? It happened. And if we don't address it and we don't hit it head on and we don't talk to people about it, it's going to keep happening to other people.
And that was one of the things, too, that we looked at was, you know, suicide has many different parts to it. It's not usually based off of one thing. They don't have one single cause. So it could have different things like substance abuse or untreated depression, or even treated depression. They have a higher risk of suicide. And I think it's super important that we know what those warning signs are. Because I know you and I, and maybe in hindsight, we see a little bit of that now, but...
But like we talked about, and you'll hear in episode 5, we discussed, you know, the guilt that you carry after someone in your family does that. And for us, it's pretty heavy and it's deep. But for someone who's trained to see these symptoms, to trained, like professionally trained psychologist, it's fairly simple on their end. You know, I had such a guilt, and I was asked, Well, when were you trained to see these symptoms? Well, of course, never. But it's my daughter, I should know. Well, you shouldn't know, because some of the symptoms or some of the signs are things that you're thinking in everyday life, like they're so nonchalant or insignificant in and of themselves. If it was just that one thing, you would never be led to that conclusion. So some of them, if you don't know and you don't have any sort of training, you're never going to see that coming.
Right.
So that's why it becomes important to have the open, candid conversations and let people know.
So some of the warning signs, maybe we can let some of our visitors know here what those are. And the warning signs that we're going to share with you now are ones that are pretty pretty strong indicators that you may need help urgently. And one of them is people talking about wanting to die or to kill themselves, or looking for a way to do that.
One of them on our list that really sticks out to me, and of course I'm skipping, is talking about being a burden to others. Now, in the few days before Morgan passed, I can recall her saying that several times, like, oh, I don't want to be a burden, or, you know, she said it several times, and it never stuck, like, it never rang a bell, and I'm like, don't be silly, you're never a burden, it's family, that's what family does, you know, and she's down, and she's depressed, and she said it, I don't know how many times, and now, if somebody said it, like, oh, you know, all the hair on my neck would stand up, and I would be alert, but initially, that's not something that would have raised a red flag to me. And the other thing, another one is feeling hopeless or like you don't have a purpose or I'm not good enough for anybody. And why do I even try? Those are all sort of things that had come up recently before she passed that just didn't, you know, in conversation. And like the day she called and said, I'm crazy. Of course you're not crazy, you know, and I talk her out of it. But those conversations now will have a different tone with me. You know, I will start asking questions instead of telling them, no, you're fine.
I think the one too that a couple of them that caught me off guard were sleeping too little or too much and then just being anxious, agitated, reckless to me, and mood swings, extreme mood swings. To me, that could be a teenager.
I mean, yes.
We've all had teenagers coming through our house, and some days, I know why animals eat their youngs some days.
And the other is showing rage or seeking revenge. And if you think about, look at social media now, that seems to be a very commonplace thing, something that we never would have done when we were young, but it happens all the time now. So when you start looking at some of these major red flags or the warning signs, they're everywhere. How do you pick apart that? You know, if you have this person that sleeps a lot, is withdrawn, has some rage, has mood swings, talking about being a burden, how do you pick that apart and say, like, hey, is this an everyday down, or is there something else going on?
Yeah, I think that's where the communication comes in, and if they don't want to talk to me, that would probably be another clue, possibly. But again, it's hard to know where people are, and if you're not close to them, you know, or don't live under the same house or same roof where you could see that on a daily basis, it would be an extreme challenge. So I think it's just important, again, during this pandemic has changed a lot of things. When we couldn't see people, we couldn't hug people, we couldn't, you know, physically
right.
see them.
You do get a lot out of face-to-face value when you're talking to someone that you don't get when you're on the phone or you're somewhere else.
Yeah, and, you know, that kind of leads into, so what is their mental health and how are they doing? You know, in order for them to be healthy mentally, you should be able to cope with stress and you should be able to work productively and have your full potential and make meaningful contributions. But when you're not healthy physically, socially, or emotionally, what kind of toll does that take on your body? And have we all been there at some point?
Oh, I believe if any adult said, no, I've never had any issues like that, I would think that would be a lie. Have I ever had issues to the point where I said I'm going to kill myself? No, and I'm not there. And so it is hard for us to put ourselves in that state of mind. But if I thought I've never felt useless or I've never struggled with connecting with people or wanting to be isolated or just feeling exhausted with life, oh, absolutely, that happens. And it happens to everyone. It's just the depth of it is where the problems come in.
Right. And I think one of the things too is, again, you've got to reach out. And it's hard to reach out when you're in that despair, but you've got to talk to someone. And even if it's a complete stranger, even if it's a family member, counseling seems to be a big stigma for some reason, and I don't know why. But I think it's important to get the help that you need and have somebody validate what you're feeling and letting you know that it's okay or not okay and getting you the help you need to improve your mental health.
We talked about counseling a lot now that she's gone, and there are certain people in my family that, and my son is one, absolutely, he's just not giving in, doesn't want to do that. But now he's very much like my brother, who is this big, burly, masculine, strong man, owns his own business, does all this manly stuff, you know. And he was one of the first ones in the family that collapsed and said, I can't do this, I need help, you know. And I think it all comes down to how you perceive counseling. Like, my son's like, I don't want someone picking me apart and telling me everything that's wrong with me. And in reality, they're not going to tell you a whole lot of counseling you don't already know about yourselves, because we are our worst critics, right? Mm-hmm. So there's days where I know I seem off. There's days that I know I'm exhausted or I'm withdrawn. So is there something this counselor is going to tell me that's going to be like, oh, wow, I didn't know that? No, you know these things. But it gives you someone on the outside that you can just get it out and you spit it out and you can sort it out and manage it piece at a time. And really, I think what they think counseling is sometimes and what it really is, there's two completely different things.
And I think if nothing else, it's a safe place for you to express those emotions. And I guess for me, I've not gotten to that point. I know we had another family member reach out that has also experienced this and said, you know, have you gone through counseling? And I haven't. I've had some of our friends who have. I think it's up to you. I think you need to be able to determine whether you need it or not. And sometimes if you're down and that depressed and you can't determine that, then hopefully your family would recognize that for you as well.
I think initially, of course, we, you know, Morgan passed, and it shortly thereafter we got into the COVID and you couldn't do anything face to face. And I'm a very much I make jokes, I have a face made for radio, but no, I'm a very much a face-to-face person. I can have 10 times a conversation sitting there looking in your eye, seeing your expressions, seeing how you interact, than I can over the phone or via online, but nobody was seeing anybody in person. So I did, and early on, did I want to pick everything in my brain apart? Absolutely not. You're going to have to process it on your own time, but what I seemed to migrate to was the parents' group settings. It was almost like going to a group on a Tuesday night at a church, like a grief share, but we were online. It was a chat room where we did a Zoom or whatever. And a lot of times in those, and I've referred a couple of people, like, try it. I don't want to talk. You don't have to talk. That's the best thing about a group parent meeting. You don't have to talk. What you can do is sit back and listen to those who do want to talk, and just take a self-inventory, like, gosh, I do that. Nope, don't have that problem. Oh, that's me. And then pretty soon you're figuring out, like, I am so connected to these people that, of course, then it naturally comes about that you will talk or you'll type in there. And so I did that for a while. And then I kind of pulled back and I just saw my family doctor occasionally and did some antidepressants. And where I'm at right now is I think I'm stuck between the anger stage. Guilt and anger, I don't know, but I've come to a kind of a spot where I'm just sick of feeling this way. So it is time for me to do something different. So, and I don't know how many people know, but tomorrow will be I was diagnosed with PTSD. And so tomorrow will be my first psychotherapy appointment with a doctor who specializes in PTSD and these sorts of traumas. So maybe the next episode we'll have some different feedback for you, but everybody does it in their own time. I am super stubborn, and I thought I can handle this. I've handled everything else in my life. Well, there's never been anything like this in my life. So I'm at 14 months, and I'm going to see a psychiatrist.
Good for you.
God help them. God help them.
I will say a prayer for them.
Yeah. But, you know, you know in your own heart, in your own mind, when you've exhausted every every, you know, weapon in your arsenal, and you just can't, you know, it's a hard thing to accept for us. That part of that is losing a child is you have zero control over everything that happens in your life now. Up until that point, like, I'm the boss, I have this down. Nope, I have zero control. I'm just along for the ride, basically. And so at least maybe going to this therapy will give me the option to put my seatbelt on or not, you know? Right. Give me some tools, some different ways to handle things.
Well, good for you. One of the other things, there is a mentalhealth.gov website that you can go to if you want some more information on mental health and the wellness, I guess. But the other thing that we wanted to touch basis on today, too, was suicide and the numbers. They have really jumped, especially in the last 2 years. Our most current information that we have is from 2019, and we know since then it has gone up. And right now it leads, it's the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S., and it's the second leading cause of death for 15 to 24-year-olds.
So both of our girls fell in that group.
Yep.
So let's talk about that for 1 second before we go on. 15 to 24-year-olds, what is happening in our life at that time that you could contribute, or that we think, you know, looking at our girls, that was so overwhelming? Why is it that group of people?
I think personally, and this is just my own personal thoughts, I think social media plays a part in that. I think they're becoming independent and out on their own. They're trying to navigate the world and, you know, cope with the different things that are happening. They're paying bills, they're adulting, you know, or becoming adults. And I think that is a huge challenge, and maybe not being able to cope with that.
And we had talked earlier today, just in our normal conversation, about social media and just media in general, you know, some of the staples or mainstays in entertainment right now is reality TV. That's somewhat bizarre. That's not real life. Nobody, I don't know anybody that lives like that. Or the amount of connectivity that our kids and young adults have, even adults our age, you know. So when we were younger, we went to school, we went to our sports afterwards, and then what do we have after that? You had home. Right. And if you wanted to talk to me when I was at home, you had to call my mom's phone in the kitchen that had this 30-foot cord so she could walk around the house while she was talking. And you had to talk on that where everybody in the house was listening. Now think about the conversations that our kids have with each other. Are they going to have that in our kitchen on a phone where everybody can hear them? Absolutely not.
Heaven forbid, no.
Social media, cell phones, has given them 24-hour connectivity. So if you are, you know, having a great time in life, 24 hours of getting your ego boosted, hey, you know, that makes you feel pretty good. But if you're not that guy, if you're not that kid, and you're the kid that maybe doesn't fit in or struggles or gets picked on, that gives you 24 hours a day of constant connectivity to people who, you know, are maybe bullying you or don't like you or make you feel like you're different than them, or you're looking at these people like, why am I not like them, or why do I feel this way? That's a lot. That's a huge burden on these kids. So this age group starts at 15. At 15, are you anywhere near prepared to handle that sort of stuff?
No, absolutely not.
So we're giving them a 24-hour feed right into their brain, telling them how you should be, how you shouldn't be, what you should look like, what you shouldn't look like, why people like you, why they don't like you. That's a lot to process. So they're, you know, while they're going through the stages of learning to be a new adult, and it's not easy. That those young 20s, they're not easy unless you are blessed, you know, and you're, you know, it's a struggle. You learn who you are and who you're not, who your friends aren't. But when you're also battling looking at everybody else's blessed life on the internet, which sometimes is crap, but you're comparing yourself to them, it's a constant beat down if you're not that one on the top rung. And I think that played a lot into it. To Morgan, I mean, she had constantly had people talking to her, telling her, this is what's going on, or you should be doing this, or why are you doing that? It's just, people will say a lot of stuff through a text message, through social media, on the internet, that they would never say to your face, ever. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at some of the stuff that kids say now, and I'm thinking, my mom would smack my lips 2 blocks away at 43 if I talked to people like that. But these are 10, 12, 13-year-old kids, and they're just awful. it brings a level of brash, bold, and entitlement to kids that we didn't have when we were younger because we weren't connected everywhere. You had that family connectivity at night, and it seems to have grounded us in a different way. So I think they're just getting a lot at them at all times.
I would agree. One of the other things that stood out to me, and again, this is based off 2019, there's no updated information that we can find, but every 11.1 minutes, somebody is committing suicide.
How long have we been talking today?
We have been talking for approximately 35, 40 minutes.
So think about how our world shattered in that one day we lost our daughter. So in this time we've been having this conversation, four people left this world. Those four people, you know, of course their mothers were shattered, but how far reaching is their one loss? So when one person dies, how many people are affected by that?
I would guess, you know, they're basing their studies, I believe, off six people per person, which we know is much more than that.
Yeah.
But it was talking like, what was it, 5.4 million people are affected by suicide. Yeah, 5.4. The number of survivors of suicide loss in the U.S. is more than 5.4 million, and that grew by over, almost 300,000 in 1 year.
Insane.
Yeah.
That was a conversation I remember having with a friend fairly soon after Morgan passed. He'd battled with suicidal thoughts of himself, and he said, you know, it never played into my thinking when I was having those thoughts of, you know, how many people would really be affected. He said, I had no concept of the vast impact one suicide has until Morgan left. He said, and then I saw how wide-reaching it was. He said, I'm so glad that I changed my mind, but think about the millions of people that don't change their mind.
Right.
That person every 11 minutes. So if you had a map of the United States and if you pinpointed every person that committed suicide, and then you put your ring around them, and this is how big of the outreach it was, it would be a total cluster. So we were talking earlier about our family. I have two nephews that committed suicide, and another friend of my daughter and youngest nephew, and then my daughter, and I had a cousin, and I had a boy I babysit, and I had a friend that committed suicide. So I have seven right there, and it's just that I could just rattle off right away. So if I widen my ring just a little bit more, just think of how many lives are intertwined in this, and nobody wants to address this head on and talk about it.
Right. And I think that's part of our reason for doing this is we want to open up that discussion. We want to help anyone that we can, and just letting them know that first and foremost that their emotions are validated and yours may not be the same as ours, but we want to share our story so that you may not feel isolated, hopefully. But if you do have thoughts of harming yourself, you can always call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline, which is 1-800-273-8255. Again, 1-800-273-8255.
One thing to remember too, that hotline is not always, isn't restricted to just people that are thinking about suicide. If you know someone that has exhibited symptoms and you're concerned about them, you can call that number and talk to a professional that will give you resources, will tell you what to do, will give you a little bit of information so you're a little more informed than maybe we were. And there's also suicidepreventionlifeline.org that will give you statistics, things to look for, that will give you resources, places to get help, you know, for different sorts of things. So those aren't just for people wanting to commit suicide. They're also for people that want to help someone that they think is maybe sliding. Use those, mentalhealth.org, check them out, look at the symptoms, do some little self-evaluation or some family evaluation and see if there's something you're missing or something that maybe you should be addressing.
And then one of the other things that we, and I think we kind of talked about this a little bit, is, you know, are there signs and can we prevent it? And I don't know that we're going to be able to prevent every single suicide. In fact, I would say no. Some people can hide things very well. But I think if we know what the signs are and we're proactive about it, we may be able to prevent one in the future of someone who is close to us or even our own selves, just recognizing that somebody needs that help. So that really is our ultimate goal, is to be able to help.
Right. And part of that is normalizing the conversation when kids are little. You know, you'll see this kid that seems withdrawn or not playing with anybody, or he's upset and crying, and we're like, stop it, stop crying, go play, it's not that big of a deal. Sometimes for them it is a big deal. So if we make it okay, when they're children, for them to come to us and say, I'm not feeling okay, express how they're feeling and deal with it, it's going to change the way they think about it when they get older. It's okay to not be okay some days. It's not okay to not be okay alone. You don't have to do it by yourself. You don't have to do it in silence. So we have to get to a point where we're talking about it. And this is the only way we know how. Clearly, Dawn and I will never run for public office. Our closets are full, and we'd like to keep those skeletons in there. So we're not perfect people by any means, and we didn't live a perfect life. We're not awful people, but this is the only thing we know how to do to get through on our end and to make sure that maybe some other parents or family members don't have to do this. So if you do have questions, please call us, reach out to us. We'll more than gladly talk to you, but I don't have all the answers. I wish I did. I might not be sitting here if I did, but we're just average everyday people, and we want to open up the narrative about this so we can maybe make it more commonplace.
Tricia, would you want to share our Facebook page with our viewers so that they can join us on there as well?
And that is The New You, Life After a Loss to Suicide, at The New You 97. It will take you right to our Facebook page.
Awesome.
You can drop us a message there. There's access to our podcast on there. And we post random things on there. We'll get a little better about keeping that going. We're just in our learning stages with our training wheels on here, but we're getting there.
We are. Well, we would like to thank everyone for joining us for episode 6. And again, if you have any questions or comments, feel free to go to our Facebook page and leave us some messages or just hit the like button. We'd love to hear from you. And until next time, have a great day.
Have a great day.
If you or someone you know is in crisis or struggling with mental health or suicidal thoughts, call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK. Again, that's 1-800-273-8255. Remember, you're never alone. You can also find resources at suicidepreventionlifeline.org.